Trent's Last Case, E.C. Bentley. Chapter 9. A Hot Scent.
"Come in," called Trent.
Mr. Cupples entered his sitting room at the hotel. It was the early evening of the day on which the coroner's jury, without leaving the box, had pronounced the expected denunciation of a person or persons unknown. Trent, with a hasty glance upward, continued his intent study of what lay in a photographic dish of enameled metal, which he moved slowly about in the light of the window. He looked very pale, and his movements were nervous. "Sit on the sofa," he advised. "The chairs are a job lot, bought at the sale after the suppression of the Holy Inquisition in Spain. This is a pretty good negative," he went on, holding it up to the light, with his head at the angle of discriminating judgment. "Washed enough now, I think. Let's leave it to dry and get rid of all this mess." Mr. Cupples, as the other busily cleared the table of a confusion of basins, dishes, racks, boxes, and bottles, picked up first one and then another of the objects and studied them with innocent curiosity. "That is so-called hypo-eliminator," said Trent, as Mr. Cupples uncorked and smelt at one of the bottles. "Very useful when you're in a hurry with a negative. I shouldn't drink it, though, all the same. It eliminates sodium hypophosphite, which I shouldn't wonder if it would eliminate human beings, too." He found a place for the last of the litter on the crowded mantel shelf and came to sit before Mr. Cupples on the table. "The great thing about a hotel sitting room is that its beauty does not detract the mind from work. It's no place for the mayfly pleasures of a mind at ease. Have you ever been in this room before, Cupples?"
"I have, hundreds of times.
It has pursued me all over England for years. I should feel lost without it if, in some fantastic, far-off hotel, they were to give me some other sitting room. Look at this table cover. There's the ink I spilt on it when I had this room in Halifax. I burnt that hole in the carpet when I had it in Ipswich. But I see they've mended the glass over the picture of Silent Sympathy, which I threw a boot at in Banbury. I do all my best work here. This afternoon, for instance, since the inquest, I've finished several excellent negatives. There's a very good dark room downstairs."
"The inquest. That reminds me," said Mr. Cupples, who knew that this sort of talk in Trent meant the excitement of action, and was wondering what he could be about.
"I came in to thank you, my dear fellow, for looking after Mabel this morning. I had no idea she was going to feel ill after leaving the box. She seemed quite unmoved, and really, she's a woman of such extraordinary self-command. I thought I could leave her to her own devices and hear out the evidence, which I thought it important I should do. It was a very fortunate thing she found a friend to assist her, and she's most grateful. She's quite herself again now." Trent, with his hands in his pockets and a slight frown on his brow, made no reply to this. "I tell you what," he said after a short pause, "I was just getting to the really interesting part of the job when you came in. Come, would you like to see a little bit of high-class police work? It's the very same kind of work that old Murch ought to be doing at this moment. Perhaps he is, but I hope to glory he isn't." He sprang off the table and disappeared into his bedroom. Presently, he came out with a large drawing board on which a number of heterogeneous objects was arranged. "First, I must introduce you to these little things," he said, setting them out on the table. "Here's a big ivory paper knife. Here are two leaves cut out of a diary, my own diary. Here is a bottle containing dentifrice. Here's a little case of polished walnut. Some of these things have to be put back where they belong in somebody's bedroom at White Gables before night. That's the sort of man I am. Nothing stops me. I borrowed them this very morning when everyone was down at the inquest, and I dare say some people would think it rather an odd proceeding if they knew. Now, there remains one object on the board. Can you tell me without touching it? What is it?"
"Certainly I can," said Mr. Cupples, peering at it with great interest. "It's an ordinary glass bowl. It looks like a finger bowl. I see nothing odd about it." he added, after some moments of close scrutiny. "I can't see much myself," replied Trent. "And that is exactly where the fun comes in. Now, take this little fat bottle, Couples, and pull out the cork. Do you recognize that powder inside it? You've swallowed pounds of it in your time, I expect. They give it to babies. Gray powder is its ordinary name. Mercury and chalk. It's great stuff. Now, while I hold the basin sideways over this sheet of paper, I want you to pour a little powder out of the bottle over this part of the bowl. Just here. Perfect! Sir Edward Henry himself could not have handled the powder better. You've done this before, Couples, I can see. You're an old hand." "I really am not," said Couples seriously, as Trent returned the fallen powder to the bottle. "I assure you it's all a complete mystery to me. What did I do then?" "I brushed the powdered part of the bowl lightly with this camel hair brush. Now, look at it again. You saw nothing odd about it before. Do you see anything now?" Mr. Couples peered again. "How curious," he said. "Yes, there are two large gray finger marks on the bowl. They weren't there before." "I am Harkshaw the detective," observed Trent. "Would it interest you to hear a short lecture on the subject of glass finger bowls? When you take one up with your hand, you leave traces upon it, usually practically invisible, which may remain for days or months. You may leave the marks of your fingers. The human hand, even when quite clean, is never quite dry, and sometimes, in moments of great anxiety, for instance, Couples, it's very moist. It leaves a mark on any cold, smooth surface it may touch. That bowl was moved by somebody with a rather moist hand quite lately." He sprinkled the powder again. "Here, on the other side, you see, is the thumb mark. Very good impressions, all of them." He spoke without raising his voice, but Mr. Couples could perceive that he was ablaze with excitement as he stared at the faint gray marks. "This one should be the index finger. I need not tell a man of your knowledge of the world that the pattern on it is a single spiral whorl with deltas symmetrically disposed. This, the print of the second finger, is a simple loop with a staple core and 15 counts. I know there are 15 because I've just the same two prints on this negative, which I've examined in detail. Look." He held one of the negatives up to the light of the declining sun and demonstrated with a pencil point. "You can see they're the same. You see the bifurcation at that ridge? There it is in the other. You see that little scar near the center? There it is in the other. There are a score of ridge characteristics on which an expert would swear in the witness box that the marks on that bowl and the marks I have photographed on this negative were made by the same hand." "And where did you photograph them? What does it all mean?" asked Couples, wide-eyed. "I found them on the inside of the left-hand leaf of the front window in Mrs. Manderson's bedroom. As I could not bring the window with me, I photographed them, sticking a bit of black paper on the other side of the glass for the purpose. The bowl comes from Manderson's room. It's the bowl in which his false teeth were placed at night. I could bring that away, so I did." "But those cannot be Mabel's finger marks." "I should think not," said Trent with decision. "They're twice the size of any print Mrs. Manderson could make." "Then they must be her husband's." "Perhaps they are. Now, shall we see if we can match them once more?" "I believe we can." Whistling faintly and very white in the face, Trent opened another small, squat bottle containing a dense black powder. "Lamp black," he explained. "Hold a bit of paper in your hand for a second or two, and this little chap will show you the pattern of your fingers." He carefully took up, with a pair of tweezers, one of the leaves cut from his diary, and held it out for the other to examine. No marks appeared on the leaf. He tilted some of the powder out upon the surface of the paper, then turning it over upon the other. Then shook the leaf gently to rid it of the loose powder. He held it out to Mr. Couples in silence. On one side of the paper appeared unmistakably, clearly printed in black, the same two fingerprints that he'd already seen on the bowl and on the photographic plate. He took up the bowl and compared them. Trent turned the paper over, and on the other side was a bold black replica of the thumb mark that was printed in gray on the glass in his hand. "Same man, you see," Trent said with a short laugh. "I felt it must be so, and now I know." He walked to the window and looked out. "Now I know," he repeated in a low voice, as if to himself. His tone was bitter. Mr. Cupples, understanding nothing, stared at his motionless back for a few moments. "I'm still completely in the dark," he ventured presently. "I have often heard of this fingerprint business and wondered how the police went to work about it. It's of extraordinary interest to me, but upon my life I cannot see how in this case Manderson's fingerprints are going..." "I'm very sorry, Cupples," Trent broke in upon his meditative speech, with a swift return to the table. "When I began this investigation, I meant to take you with me every step of the way. You mustn't think I have any doubts about your discretion if I say now that I must hold my tongue about the whole thing, at least for a time. But I will tell you this. I have come upon a fact that looks too much like having very painful consequences if it is discovered by anyone else." He looked at the other with a hard and darkened face and struck the table with his hand. "It's terrible for me here and now. Up to this moment, I was hoping against hope that I was wrong about the fact. I may still be wrong in the surmise that I base upon that fact. There's only one way of finding out that's open to me, and I must nerve myself to take it." He smiled suddenly at Mr. Cupples' face of consternation. "All right. I'm not going to be tragic anymore, and I'll tell you all about it when I can. Look here. I'm not half through my game with the powder bottles yet." He threw one of the defamed chairs to the table and sat down to test the broad ivory blade of the paper knife. Mr. Cupples, swallowing his amazement, bent forward in an attitude of deep interest and handed Trent the bottle of lamp black. Chapter 10. The Wife of Dives. Mrs. Manderson stood at the window of her sitting room at White Gables, gazing out upon a wavering landscape of fine rain and mist. The weather had broken, as it seldom does in that part in June. White wreathings drifted up the fields from the sullen sea. The sky was an unbroken gray, deadness, shedding pinpoint moisture that was now and then blown against the panes with the crepitation of despair. The lady looked out on the dim and chilling prospect with a woeful face. It was a bad day for a woman bereaved, alone, and without a purpose in life. There was a knock, and she called, "Come in," drawing herself up with an unconscious gesture that always came when she realized that the weariness of the world had been gaining upon her spirit. "Mr. Trent had called," the maid said. "He apologized for coming at such an early hour, but hoped that Mrs. Manderson would see him on a matter of urgent importance." Mrs. Manderson would see Mr. Trent. She walked to a mirror, looked into the olive face she saw reflected there, shook her head at herself with the flicker of a grimace, and turned to the door as Trent was shown in. His appearance, she noted, was changed. He had the jaded look of the sleepless, and a new and reserved expression, in which her quick sensibilities felt something, not propitious, took the place of his half-smile of fixed good humor. "May I come to the point at once?" he said, when she had given her hand. "There's a train I ought to catch at Bishopsbridge at 12 o'clock, but I cannot go until I've settled this thing, which concerns you only, Mrs. Manderson. I've been working half the night and thinking the rest, and I know now what I ought to do." "You look wretchedly tired," she said kindly. "Won't you sit down? This is a very restful chair. Of course it's about this terrible business, and your work as correspondent. Please ask me anything you think I can properly tell you, Mr. Trent. I know that you won't make it worse for me than you can help in doing your duty here. If you say you must see me about something, I know it must be because, as you say, you ought to do it.
Mrs. Manderson, said Trent, slowly measuring his words, I won't make it worse for you than I can help, but I'm bound to make it bad for you. Only between ourselves, I hope. As to whether you can properly tell me what I shall ask you, you will decide that. But I tell you this, on my word of honor, I shall ask you only as much as will decide me whether to publish or to withhold certain grave things that I have found out about your husband's death, things not suspected by anyone else, nor, I think, likely to be so. What I have discovered, what I believe that I have practically proved, will be a great shock to you in any case. But it may be worse for you than that, and if you give me reason to think it would be so, then I shall suppress this manuscript. He laid a long envelope on the small table beside him. And nothing of what it has to tell shall ever be printed. It consists, I may tell you, of a short private note to my editor, followed by a long dispatch for publication in the Record. Now, you may refuse to say anything to me. If you do refuse, my duty to my employers, as I see it, is to take this up to London with me today and leave it with my editor to be dealt with at his discretion. My view is, you understand, that I'm not entitled to suppress it on the strength of a mere possibility that presents itself to my imagination. But if I gather from you, and I can gather it from no other person, that there's substance in that imaginary possibility I speak of, then I have only one thing to do as a gentleman, and as one who, he hesitated for a phrase, wishes you well. I shall not publish that dispatch of mine. In some directions I decline to assist the police. Have you followed me so far? He asked with a touch of anxiety, in his careful coldness. For her face, but for its pallor, gave no sign as she regarded him, her hands clasped before her, and her shoulders drawn back in a pose of rigid calm. She looked precisely as she had looked at the inquest. I understand quite well, said Mrs. Manderson, in a low voice. She drew a deep breath and went on. I don't know what dreadful thing you found out, or what the possibility that has occurred to you can be, but it was good. It was honorable of you to come to me about it. Now, will you please tell me?
I cannot do that, Trent replied. The secret is my newspaper's, if it is not yours. If I find it is yours, you shall have my manuscript to read and destroy. Believe me. He broke out with something of his old warmth. I detest such mystery-making from the bottom of my soul, but it's not I who've made this mystery. This is the most painful hour of my life, and you make it worse by not treating me like a hound. The first thing I ask you to tell me, he reverted with an effort to his colorless tone, is this. Is it true, as you stated at the inquest, that you had no idea at all of the reason why your late husband had changed his attitude toward you and become mistrustful and reserved during the last few months of his life? Mrs. Manderson's dark brows lifted and her eyes flamed. She quickly rose from her chair. Trent got up at the same moment and took his envelope from the table. His manner said that he perceived the interview to be at an end. But she held up a hand, and there was color in her cheeks and quick breathing in her voice as she said, Do you know what you ask, Mr. Trent? You ask me if I perjured myself. I do, he answered unmoved. And he added after a pause, You knew already that I'd not come here to preserve the polite fictions, Mrs. Manderson. The theory that no reputable person, being on oath, could withhold a part of the truth under any circumstances is a polite fiction. He still stood as awaiting dismissal, but she was silent. She walked to the window, and he stood miserably watching the slight movement of her shoulders until it subsided. Then, with face averted, looking out on the dismal weather, she spoke, at last, clearly. "Mr. Trent," she said, "you inspire confidence in people, and I feel that things which I don't want known or talked about are safe with you. And I know you must have a very serious reason for doing what you're doing, though I don't know what it is. I suppose it would be assisting justice in some way if I told you the truth about what you asked just now. To understand that truth, you ought to know about what went on before. I mean about my marriage. After all, a good many people could tell you as well as I can that it was not a very successful union. I was only 20. I admired his force and courage and certainty. He was the only strong man I'd ever known. But it didn't take me long to find out that he cared for his business more than for me, and I think I found out even sooner than that that I'd been deceiving myself and blinding myself, promising myself impossible things, and willfully misunderstanding my own feelings, because I was dazzled by the idea of having more money to spend than an English girl ever dreams of. I've been despising myself for that for 5 years. My husband's feeling for me, well, I cannot speak of that. What I want to say is that, along with it, there has always been a belief of his that I was the sort of woman to take a great place in society, and that I should throw myself into it with enjoyment, and become a sort of personage, and do him great credit. That was his idea. And the idea remained with him after other delusions had gone. I was a part of his ambition. That was his really bitter disappointment, that I failed him as a social success. I think he was too shrewd not to have known in his heart that such a man as he was, 20 years older than I, with great business responsibilities that filled every hour of his life and caring for nothing else, he must have felt that there was a risk of great unhappiness in marrying the sort of girl I was, brought up to music and books and unpractical ideas, always enjoying myself in my own way. But he had really reckoned on me as a wife who would do the honors of his position in the world, and I found I couldn't. Mrs. Manderson had talked herself into a more emotional mood than she had yet shown to Trent. Her words flowed freely, and her voice had begun to ring and give play to a natural expressiveness that must hitherto have been dulled, he thought, by the shock and self-restraint of the past few days. Now she turned swiftly from the window and faced him as she went on, her beautiful face flushed and animated, her eyes gleaming, her hands moving in slight emphatic gestures, as she surrendered herself to the impulse of giving speech to things long pent up. "The people," she said. "Oh, those people! Can you imagine what it must be for anyone who's lived in a world where there are always creative work in the background, work with some dignity about it, men and women with professions or arts to follow, with ideals and things to believe in and quarrel about, some of them wealthy, some of them quite poor? Can you think what it means to step out of that into another world where you have to be very rich, shamefully rich, to exist at all, where money is the only thing that counts and the first thing in everybody's thoughts, where the men who make the millions are so jaded by the work that sport is the only thing that they can occupy themselves with when they have any leisure, and the men who don't have to work are even duller than the men who do, and vicious as well, and the women live for display and silly amusements and silly immoralities. Do you know how awful that life is? Of course I know there are clever people, and people of taste in that set, but they're swamped and spoiled, and it's the same thing in the end. Empty. Empty. Oh, I suppose I'm exaggerating. And I did make friends and have some happy times, but that's how I feel after it all. The seasons in New York and London, how I hated them. And our house parties, and cruises in the yacht and the rest, the same people, the same emptiness. And you see, don't you, that my husband couldn't have an idea of all this. His life was never empty. He did not live it in society. And when he was in society, he had always his business plans and difficulties to occupy his mind. He hadn't a suspicion of what I felt, and I never let him know. I couldn't. It wouldn't have been fair. I felt I must do something to justify myself as his wife, sharing his position and fortune. And the only thing I could do was to try to live up to his idea about my social qualities. I did try. I acted my best, and it became harder year after year. I never was what they call a popular hostess. How could I be? I was a failure, but I went on trying. I used to steal holidays now and then. I used to feel as if I was not doing my part of a bargain. It sounds horrid to put it like that, I know, but it was so. When I took one of my old school friends, who couldn't afford to travel, away to Italy for a month or two, and we went about cheaply, all by ourselves, and were quite happy. Or when I went and made a long stay in London with some quiet people who had known me all my life, and we all lived just as in the old days, when we had to think twice about seats at the theater and told each other about cheap dressmakers. Those and a few other expeditions of the same sort were my best times after I was married, and they helped me to go through with it the rest of the time. But I felt my husband would have hated to know how much I enjoyed every hour of those returns to the old life. And in the end, in spite of everything I could do, he came to know. He could see through anything, I think, once his attention was turned to it. He had always been able to see that I was not fulfilling his idea of me as a figure in the social world, and I suppose he thought it was my misfortune rather than my fault. But the moment he began to see, in spite of my pretending, that I wasn't playing my part with any spirit, he knew the whole story. He divined how I loathed and was weary of the luxury and the brilliancy and the masses of money just because of the people who lived among them, who were made so by them, I suppose. It happened last year. I don't know just how or when. It may have been suggested to him by some woman, for all they understood, of course. He said nothing to me, and I think he tried not to change in his manner to me at first. But such things hurt, and it was working in both of us. I knew that he knew. After a time, we were just being polite and considerate to each other. Before he found me out, we'd been on a footing of, how can I express it to you? Of intelligent companionship, I might say. We talked without restraint of many things of the kind we could agree or disagree about, without its going very deep, if you understand. And then that came to an end. I felt that the only possible basis of our living in each other's company was going under my feet. And at last, it was gone. It had been like that, she ended simply, for months before he died. She sank into the corner of a sofa by the window, as though relaxing her body after an effort. For a few moments, both were silent. Trent was hastily sorting out a tangle of impressions. He was amazed at the frankness of Mrs. Manderson's story. He was amazed at the vigorous expressiveness in her telling of it. In this vivid being, carried away by an impulse to speak, talking with her whole personality, he'd seen the real woman in a temper of activity, as he had already seen the real woman by chance in a temper of reverie and unguarded emotion. In both, she was very unlike the pale, self-disciplined creature of majesty that she had been to the world. With that amazement of his went something like terror of her dark beauty, with excitement kindled into an appearance scarcely mortal in his eyes. Incongruously, there rushed into his mind, occupied as it was with the affair of the moment, a little knot of ideas. She was unique, not because of her beauty, but because of its being united with intensity of nature. In England, all the very beautiful women were placid. All the fiery women seemed to have burnt up the rest of their beauty. But that was why no beautiful women had ever cast this sort of spell on him before. When it was a question of wit in women, he had preferred the brighter flame to the duller, without much regarding the lamp. "All this is very disputable," said his reason, and instinct answered, "Yes, except that I'm under a spell." And a deeper instinct cried out, "Away with it." He forced his mind back to her story and found growing swiftly in him an irrepressible conviction. It was all very fine, but it would not do. "I feel as if I had led you into saying more than you meant to say, or than I wanted to learn," he said slowly. "But there is one brutal question which is the whole point of my inquiry." He braced his frame like one preparing for a plunge into cold waters. "Mrs. Manderson, will you assure me that your husband's change toward you had nothing to do with John Marlowe?" And what he had dreaded came. "Oh!" she cried, with a sound of anguish, her face thrown up and open hands stretched out as if for pity. And then the hands covered the burning face, and she flung herself aside among the cushions at her elbow, so that he saw nothing but her heavy crown of black hair, and her body moving with sobs that stabbed his heart, and a foot turned inward gracelessly in an abandonment of misery. Like a tall tower suddenly breaking apart, she had fallen in ruins, helplessly weeping. Trent stood up, his face white and calm. With a senseless particularity, he placed his envelope exactly in the center of the little polished table. He walked to the door, closed it noiselessly as he went out, and in a few minutes was tramping through the rain out of sight of White Gables, going nowhere, seeing nothing, his soul shaken in the fierce effort to kill and trample the raving impulse that had seized him in the presence of her shame, that clamored to him to drag himself before her feet, to pray for pardon, to pour out words. He knew not what words, but he knew that they had been straining at his lips. To wreck his self-respect forever and hopelessly defeat even the crazy purpose that had almost possessed him by drowning her wretchedness in disgust, by babbling with the tongue of infatuation to a woman with a husband not yet buried, to a woman who loved another man. Such was the magic of her tears, quickening in a moment the thing which, as his heart had known, he must not let come to life. For Philip Trent was a young man, younger in nature even than his years, and a way of life that kept his edge keen and his spirit volcanic had prepared him very ill for the meeting that comes once in the early manhood of most of us, usually, as in this case, he told himself harshly, to no purpose but the testing of virtue and the power of the will.